ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
Have you ever gone to the doctor feeling miserable and hoping to get some medication, only to be told, it's a virus, antibiotics won't help? One of the challenges in treating viral infections is that viruses themselves are incredibly difficult to understand. But a team of scientists at UW-Milwaukee have developed an amazing technique to not only see viruses, but they've created three-dimensional movies showing how viruses infect healthy cells. In the studio with us today are Abbas Ormaz, Ahmad Hosseini, and Peter Schwander. All are from UW-Milwaukee's internationally recognized Department of Physics. They're key members of a research project that's revolutionizing our understanding of viruses and laying the foundation for the development of new treatments for deadly viruses that infect millions of people around the world every year. Welcome to the program, gentlemen. Good to have all of you with us. And what an honor, because your work has received attention all over the world. Abbas, study of viruses, it's not an easy thing, is it?
It's not. They're difficult to control. As you know, we made 3D movies of these viruses. Now, if you want to make a 3D movie of people, you get yourself a bunch of actors. You put them on a stage. You have well-defined camera positions. And then the movie goes ahead. The actors do what the director tells them to do. Well, you can't tell a virus what to do. It does what it wants to do. And you take pictures of a virus, essentially, doing its own thing. You have a bunch of random snapshots. And then you have to figure out how to put these together, which orientation did they come from, and what is exactly the virus doing in each of the snapshots in order to stitch these together into a 3D movie. And that turns out requires algorithms, it requires a lot of mathematics.
And we're going to talk about that hard work that goes into it. For those folks who may never have seen a virus, shouldn't be surprising, because they're extraordinarily difficult to see in the first place, aren't they?
Well, it turns out a virus typically is about a thousandth of the width of a human hair. And so they're not easy to see. But we used very bright sources of X-rays. In fact, we used a source of X-ray which is 10 billion times brighter than anything available before. And by using these very short pulses of these very intense lasers, X-ray laser, we managed to capture the viruses going about their business.
And that, of course, takes a lot of work behind the scene in order to put all of those pieces together, doesn't it?
Exactly. And in fact, this work was part of an international collaboration involving a large team. But I'd like to think that UWM was one of the leading teams in this activity. But these are really big experiments. The X-ray laser I just mentioned is a kilometer long.
Well, and let's bring our other colleagues in. Peter, let's talk about your role in this process.
My role was first, I started actually about in 2008 with algorithms. We actually started with algorithms before we had images and the technology came out. The technology came out about 2011 when we did the first snapshots in Stanford at this ultra-bright flashlight, if you want, where we can take images which are in a fraction, it's like 50 femtosecond. It's a very short time. And then we collected the snapshots, and my major role was to be sure that we get enough snapshots. There were other people involved in the sample preparation and doing the experiments, but my major role was to make sure that we get enough snapshots of good quality. And then I had lots of data and brought it back to UWM, and we started the analysis. And then that was, I think that the data analysis was really the part, where UWM gets the credit. And surprisingly, actually, we saw much more details that we anticipated, because initially we thought, well, the virus would be always the same. Right, we just see it in different orientation, but otherwise it's always the same object. And as a positive surprise, we saw that the virus is doing something, and I'm lucky that we had these algorithms already in our pocket to tackle that.
I want to bring in Ahmed here, because speaking of algorithms, this was a bit of homework that you worked on for 4 years, I understand?
Well, almost 5 years.
5 years on the same problem.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Well, actually, in scientific research, one has to be very patient, especially when we set the bar high. And this is the case in our research group. In the beginning of this project, we knew that this is a tough problem. But we also knew that there should be an answer for that. So in 2011, when I joined the group of Dr. Umaz, I started to work on an algorithm in order to find the structure of a virus from thousands and millions of X-ray diffraction data. And after a year, when we, let's say, finalized this algorithm, then we started working with experimental data taken at LCLS Stanford. But the problem with the experimental data is that they are very, very difficult to deal with, because they are not just snapshots or pictures. They have many other stuff that we have to get rid of before using them for the algorithm that we designed using simulated data.
Because you had a lot of data coming to you that was not relevant to being able to picture that virus, right?
Exactly.
It was like a snowstorm with a lot of flakes or static in these images.
So we had to find ways to remove those unwanted effects and, let's say, non-virus snapshots first. And this took about 3 years of my time. And fortunately, I mean, I had, let's say, helpful support from Dr. Umaz, Dr. Schwander, and we have a friendly environment at work, and this was quite enough for me to continue working this project. And we knew that this problem has a solution. So we finally got it in 2016.
How were you confident that you had the right algorithm to work with?
We tested that on the simulated data, and then we were...
So under perfect conditions,
exactly.
You figured that this method would work.
Works,
this
yes.
Mathematical model
would work. The model works. And then we started working on experimental data.
Did Peter and Abbas, were you surprised at the diligence and the patience that you found here in Ahmed to keep plowing away year after year after year?
Well, as a scientist, as a necessity.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Holds probably for all of us
exactly.
On the table, and holds for all other scientists, I think. So I have to say, maybe I shouldn't say that loud, but I have some other people that had the same data, but at some point they said it's too difficult. So one has to be patient and curious. That's two important things in science.
I want to come back and talk more about the really, really tough, hard work of science research that you're engaged in. But first, I think it would be fun or interesting for our listeners to hear more about what that movie showed. I was amazed as I read a description of what you were able to witness when you put together these thousands of different pieces of data and created the movie. It was almost like a horror movie when you think about it. Abbas, tell us what revealed itself as you saw these viruses in action.
Well, sure, be happy to. But let me just tell you what a virus really is. A virus is almost the ultimate parasite. To give you an idea, it has the instructions to hijack the function of a cell so that it can reproduce itself. Now, you might think a virus is the ultimate parasite. It turns out viruses themselves have parasitic viruses, but that's a story for a different day. So the important thing is the virus essentially tries to hijack the mechanisms in the cell to reproduce itself. And in order to do that, it has to inject its genome, its DNA, into the cell. And this virus is very peculiar because, and what we found in, from the movie was the virus actually goes through a series of proprietary steps. And so it starts to reorganize its DNA, and as it's doing it, it builds a little tube in order to inject the DNA through. So it's
like
developing
a syringe.
Exactly. Yes. It's developing a syringe, and it's preparing the DNA to be injected through the syringe. And the big surprise was that we actually observed this. We hadn't expected it. And it turned out later this is what people actually expected, but we didn't know that at the time.
So your movie, if we can describe that very complex result of the algorithms, provided proof to that theory that that injection, in fact, was taking place.
Well, people had actually seen the tube on certain occasions, and they'd seen the virus without the tube and so on. But this was the first time there was a continuous 3D movie of the process. And in fact, it was very interesting that there was one master tactician, essentially, controlling the reorganization of the DNA so it could be injected through this syringe at the same time. And this was also unexpected.
It's as if they have a mind of their own, these viruses.
Yes, it's really remarkable. They have a mind of their own, and they use it.
What kind of viruses did you experiment with?
Well, the kind of virus we could experiment with was one which is actually safe for humans. Otherwise, we couldn't use it in this large X-ray laser. And so it turns out the virus we
You didn't want it splattering across the
we
the
didn't
walls
want to infect anyone with hepatitis D, for example. Our colleagues would never forgive us. And so we looked at a virus which is actually benign for humans and is used as a proxy to look at contamination in drinking water. It's called the PR772 virus.
So this is something that would not hurt people, but it nonetheless is representative of other viruses.
Exactly, exactly. And of course, one of the key issues is we know the viruses are in a dormant state often, where they don't do no harm, but suddenly they erupt, they become virulent, and the question is, how does that happen?
Did you find out yet?
Well, we have now found out how the virus goes from this benign capsid to being virulent by injecting a syringe, essentially by developing a syringe. But this is the case for this virus. The question is, for example, what happens with the flu virus? Because the flu virus changes from year to year. That's why we keep catching it and we keep having to renew our flu shots. The key question here is which parts of the flu virus do not change, because those are the parts you want to attack.
Ah, so you could develop a vaccine that would be useful regardless of the mutations that occur, because you're going after some basic common denominator.
That's the $100,000 question. And of course, we are contributing to that, I hope, in a general sense. But we're not involved in that directly, of course, with the flu. But we hope that as one understands the mechanisms by which viruses become virulent, by the mechanisms and the mechanisms they evolve to survive our immune system, can be helped by the understanding we are getting from viruses.
You mentioned a little bit about the fact that you had colleagues in other parts of the country who were tackling different parts of this question or this problem. Let's talk about who those partners were and also your sponsors, the National Science Foundation, which is the one that really, the organization that really made this all possible, right?
That's right. This is a part of a science and technology center funded by the National Science Foundation. It's $35 million for 5 years, and 5 years are going to be up in about a year, and we were fortunate enough to be told 2 weeks ago that it's been renewed for another 5 years beyond that.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And this consists of 11 U.S. institutions, most distinguished institutions, Stanford, for example, University of California, San Francisco, University of New York at Buffalo, and UWM is one of the leading partners, and of course, Arizona State University. But this effort itself to do with viruses actually involves, it's an international team. So it involves people from Germany, involves people from Sweden, involves even people from Australia, and it's a multinational team, and it's a real pleasure to work with such a large team.
Let's talk about the equipment that that is behind this. Ahmed, you talked about the math, but Peter, you mentioned the X-ray laser.
Yes.
It's a pretty big piece of equipment.
It's a pretty big piece. It's about 1 kilometer long.
1 kilometer long.
Yeah, and actually it's interesting, has an interesting history too. It used to be in the 60s, 70s, be an accelerator for accelerator physics for electrons. And at some point, they're building all this fancy equipment in Geneva and the Hadron Collider. And then this equipment was not so much used anymore. So then some brilliant engineers, they basically transformed this equipment into an electron laser for X-rays. So basically they use electrons essentially to generate X-rays at the end of a very short pulse. It's like in the femtosecond, that's 10 to the minus 15, that's a zero and then 15, 0.15 zeros and then a one. In that order, the pulses can be created and you need a lot of, these are extremely bright. They are the brightest light sources available in the world.
So how do you protect yourself from injury when you're operating something like this?
That's a good point. So during the experiment, we're not allowed in the room where this accelerator is a big tube, right? And there's a hutch there. So when we do the experiments, we have to go out of the hutch and then there's a door. And nobody is allowed to be in. And there's a complicated security mechanism, needs training. So that scientists are allowed to work there. So nothing will happen.
Let me just, this is very important. This is an exciting instrument, of course. But Peter just mentioned the pulses are really short. They're like flashes. And how short is the flash? Well, it's a few femtoseconds. What's a femtosecond? Well, light travels a 30th of the width of human hair in 10 femtoseconds. So a 30th of the width of human hair at the speed of light in that time. That's really how short it is. And it's an intense pulse in the sense that it has 1,000 billion photons in this 10 femtosecond pulse. And so when it hits the virus, of course, is immediately destroyed, but not quite immediately, because before the virus flies apart, we take a snapshot, and then it's destroyed. And so we then have to inject another virus and intersect it with another pulse of 1,000 billion photons, and we keep repeating this process.
And so you then end up with a series of photographs of different viruses, different particles of viruses, and that's where the math comes in, right?
Exactly.
Trying to take this splatter or mosaic of exploding matter and piecing it all together.
Right.
I'm surprised you got it done in 4 years, Ahmed.
Actually, I should add that I was not alone. I mean, we are a team at the physics department of UWM, and I should mention my colleagues also did a great job here and helped me a lot for that.
And you also worked with colleagues, I suspect, in other parts of the world who were trying to move to a successful conclusion also.
Yeah, of course.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week, talking about a fascinating piece of research work conducted in part at UW-Milwaukee. As our physicists, a team of physicists at UWM, were the first ones to create a three-dimensional movie of a virus as it is in action. And what's the big deal? Well, with this information, it's possible that it could lead to not only a deeper understanding of how viruses work, but also perhaps some ideas on how to deal with those viruses that are killers. And we hear frequently of outbreaks of deadly viruses, Ebola perhaps being maybe one of the most infamous in recent years, but there are so many other viruses that do incredible, incredible damage to people. And so the gentlemen in the studio today are helping to unlock the keys, or use the keys to unlock the doorway into understanding what's going on with these viruses. Gentlemen, you talked about the research instrument out in California, the XFEL, the X-ray laser. Now, in doing some research, I saw that there's another even more powerful laser that I think is just about to come online in Germany. Peter, do you want to tell us about what
that
is?
That's right. Actually, it actually was last week when the first experiments have been done, which is also some of our colleagues from UWM went there. And it has been, quite successful, so they could get images. But at the moment, also this laser is much more powerful, and it can actually take up to 30,000 images per second, as opposed to 120, which we can do in Stanford. It's at the moment it doesn't work at the full performance, so they're doing still some tests. So to get some information, it's easier to do this with small crystals when you have more molecules instead of just one. But we're looking forward in the future to experiments there. And from what I've seen, I was also part of the team, but the remote team, staying in the U.S. in the home for this experiment. It was very successful. And it's basically has been proven that the proof of concept has been done.
So will you use or have access to that more powerful piece of equipment in Germany as you continue your research back here in Milwaukee?
Yes.
We had already, in a sense. We are also part. We got data from last week. Also, this would not be, it's not yet on this level as we are used to from the LCLS in Stanford. But
because the facilities at LCLS at SLAC will be closed for about 2 years for upgrading, and then this Germany light source will be a good opportunity for us to do experiments.
Will they be making the Stanford instrument as powerful as the one in Germany?
Yes, that's the reason they shut it down. They upgraded it, and then we hoped it will be more powerful than the one in Germany.
It sounds like some friendly competition there.
Well, I think that is friendly competition, and I want to say as a naturalized U.S. citizen, I'm really proud of the U.S., because when this instrument was built, it was open to anyone in the world who could make a good scientific case why they should be given access to it. Now, there are at least 10 times more proposals to use this machine that can be accommodated. But the U.S. was really open, and they said, we're just going to judge the projects on the strength of their excellence and not where you come from. And this model is propagating itself as other countries, for example, in Europe now, the European X-FEL is coming online. They will take the same view. Hasn't been the case with everyone. The Japanese built an X-ray laser, and they took the view, well, you have to have a Japanese collaborator in order to get access. And frankly, that model has not been so successful. So it's an argument for openness, and I'm proud that the U.S. led the way in that.
You mentioned that you just received word that the National Science Foundation is going to renew the grant. So finishing up the first 5 years, is the next one going to run another 5 years?
It is, and it's a very exciting area. It's to do with dynamics. That's to say, we are so far, if you like, the first part was, can we take still images of molecules, biological machines, and so on? And the second part is, can we actually look at the dynamics, how these things move and how function? And that's why I think this work, which my colleagues with me here today and also others who are not here today, especially Jeremy Kopperman and Ronche Mashoyeri, colleagues who are not here, that's why this is important. This work has received attention because it's a link from the present center funded by the NSF to the center which is going to be funded for the next 5 years. It's going from still images to looking at dynamics. And there are other colleagues in the center, for example, my colleague Marius Schmidt, who's also working in this direction as a collaborator. And that's, we are essentially the link, the launch pad to the next 5 years.
And will the calculations or the mathematics be the primary focus of the work being done here in Milwaukee?
Not quite. I mean, that is really our strength, I have to say. And I don't have to say it. Actually, we went through a rigorous evaluation before the center was renewed, and the we were actually identified as the center of excellence, essentially in algorithms. But not only, we were also identified as a center of excellence in Lucid Dynamics. My colleague Mario Schmidt leads that work. And so that goes to show in a way when I first came to Milwaukee, the thing which struck me was the excellence of UWM, number one, and how UWM underestimated itself, number two. I think that's being corrected.
Well, and the wonderful designation last year by Carnegie that we are one of the top 115 research universities yes. has to be based in no small measure on the fabulous work that that you and your colleagues are doing on projects like this one.
Well, I like to think you're right, but I bumped into the chancellor the other day and on my walk in the morning, and I mentioned to him, and he agreed that we are one of many excellent groups at the UWM campus.
How long before we see the discoveries that you're doing at this basic scientific level, how long before that translates into a new way of treating diseases? Any way to guesstimate or
decades,
estimate?
Decades. And this is really important because, you know, I worked at an institution called Bell Labs, and it had 11 Nobel Prizes, and I served with two of them, shoulder to shoulder. One of the leaders of Bell Labs was taken to task by people who funded him by saying, well, 90% of your projects never go to application. And he said, you're right. Actually, it's not 90%, it's even higher, 95%. The problem is I don't know which 5% work until I've actually done all the 100% of the projects. And so these are long perspective. One has to have a long perspective. But actually, sometimes one's lucky and it can be quicker. But we're looking in the long term.
Well, you all have such a patient, steady look, expression on your face. I suspect there will be no problem with you being committed and staying in for the long haul.
You should talk to my wife. She doesn't think I'm patient.
Of course, I mean, I think the experiment or the feasibility to show that we can get this movie was a very important step towards understanding function in biology, in particular shown in the case of the virus. But then I think coming to drug design, we need to have a larger team. We need more people from.
And further experiments should be done because.
Yeah, and also we need to these results bring to a larger community of medical.
Well, we're going to have you back on as your work continues. And again, congratulations and thank you for sharing your very, very fascinating story about the great work you've done on 3D movies of viruses.
Thank you very much.
Abbas Ormaz, Ahmad Hosseini, and Peter Schwander, all part of UWM's award-winning physics department, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.